In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and we've got a special two-part Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock for you today. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest is musician and songwriter Kathy Valentine, best known as a bass player in the Go-Go's. But she's been in other groups as well, including the Textones and the Blue Bonnets, and she's the author of her recent memoir, All I Ever Wanted. Here in part one, we talk about her turbulent life growing up, raised by a single mom in Austin, Texas, how she met Carla Olson and began the Textones and moved to Los Angeles. It was with the Textones that she wrote and first recorded her song Vacation, how she later presented it to the Go-Go's. However, the band's discography begins with their song We Got the Beat from the debut album Beauty and the Beat. We'll take a listen to some of that now, followed by part one of my interview with Kathy Valentine as your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. Fred here with you once again for our Coolest Conversations in Little Steven's Underground Garage. And my very special guest today is musician and songwriter Kathy Valentine, best known for being the bass player in the Go-Go's, the first and still only all-female band that both wrote their own songs, played their own instruments, and topped the Billboard album charts. In spite of our pandemic, World 2020 has been a very productive one for the band and Kathy, as there's a documentary on Showtime you can see currently about the group. The band issued a new single, Club Zero, the end of July, and Kathy has recently gotten her memoir, All I Ever Wanted, published. How are you, Kathy?
I'm good, thanks.
Well, first off, let me say thanks to you and the rest of the Go-Go's for making this most horrible of all years in recent memory, at least, much, much more bearable with the release of the new tune and the documentary and the memoir. Speaking of this dreadful year, have you and your family and friends managed to stay safe and healthy?
Yeah, it's been challenging, not for me so much, but for my daughter. I have a teenager and, you know, trying to just kind of rein it in with the friends and the social life and stuff. It's been challenging, but she's good, and you know, we're getting by, and I'm just kind of seeing a lot of silver linings. As long as we stay healthy around here, then I can cope with like working at home and all that. I enjoy being home. So,
well, you mentioned your daughter there. Your own parents divorced when you were about three, is that right?
Yeah.
And your mother raised you in that relationship is an important part of the memoir. How would you describe your mom's parenting style?
Well, in the book, I think I called it free range. And my mom, she was very young. She was very much a free spirit, kind of 60s, you know, activist, post-60s, I should say, as I was going into my adolescence, like the debauched 70s. And she pretty much, you know, didn't have a lot to offer in the terms of guidance or boundaries, but she was very supportive. Like, she never laughed when I said, oh, I'm going to be a musician. I want to quit school. And she was kind of like, yeah, whatever. So in some ways it worked out. In other ways it was tough, you know, but they all kind of blend together to make you who you are, who I am, you know?
Yeah, you mentioned about not just pretty off the charts, wild stuff for compared to, I don't know if you want to call it a normal
childhood versus a lot of experiences you had in your formative years. And not having any boundaries makes it, you know, hard to rebel. And you talk about that in the memoir, but were you conscious of that at the time as an adolescent, as wanting to be held in check or wanting to be pulled back from some of the excesses that were going on at the time, or you just kept flying?
I don't think I knew any different or any better. It just served to feel apart, you know, like it not really fit in with other people, my peers. Everyone else was kind of families, very standard boilerplate families. And although there was a lot of debauchery and, you know, drugs and drinking from all these normal kids too, supposedly normal.
Yeah.
So, but I think it just made me feel like an outsider. And like so many of us, rock and roll really, you know, soothed me and saved me and showed me, it gave me a place to focus on in terms of being out of this immediate situation, which did for a while there have a lot of unhappiness. And music was really there for me. And when I started playing, it gave me more than just kind of an out. It gave me a dream, somewhere to kind of focus on.
Well, there's a quote in the book, "Got a problem, deal with it, expel it, chop it off, abort it, and move on. It took me a long time to understand or cultivate compassion." And that abort it, I mean, that's a reference to an abortion you had at age 12, correct?
Yes. Yeah. And it really was, when I wrote that passage, when I was writing the book, I really tried not to start writing until I was in the place. You know, a lot of times I felt like I was 12-year-old Kathy writing or 15, and I hadn't been to those places in a very long time. I made it my mission to put the painful stuff, the adolescence, as far away from me as I could. And it really felt like I was going back to a life that I had, you know, discarded. Once I was writing about it, I realized that it changed me. I was like, okay, you've got to just survive. You've got to go forward. You don't feel things. It doesn't serve you to wallow, to be sorry for yourself, to have remorse. You just power ahead, which was how I survived and how I coped. But as you become a grown-up, I think we all realize eventually you can't just power through without feeling things.
Right. And it's sort of weird. It's like having that lessons and in some ways maybe that helped you deal with, you know, being in the music business or dealing with rock and roll stuff, powering on through. But in other ways, I imagine that it hurt. So in what ways did that help you, like pursuing your music dreams? And what ways did it hinder you?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. For one thing, at my core, I felt like I just didn't matter very much. And I always thought, like when I was in school, like getting straight A's or getting the teachers to like me or being funny, like just all the ways I wanted to feel like I mattered. And when it came to music, I became very ambitious and very driven to make it as a musician. Like this was it. This was how I was going to find my place in the world and be in the world. And I think that it did serve me in a way because I was very single-minded and focused. But there was also that wonderful thing of youth where you just don't see, or maybe it's not youth, maybe it was just a nature or character, but I didn't see failing. It didn't seem like an option. It didn't really, when I got in my car to go to LA to make it, it just, nothing could knock me down. And if it did, it seemed like I would find something else very quickly. I think that it did serve me, but mainly in terms of ambition and drive.
Well, talking about the music some here. So you and your mom, you're bopping around together hearing stuff on the radio, and you've got some records, I think, around that time. But then you hear this Cream record, Sunshine of Your Love. That creates sort of an awakening for you, right? How old are you then?
Yeah, I was very young. I was 9, and you would think, like as an adult, you would think like, oh, what does a 9-year-old know? But having been a mom, I saw the way music affected my daughter from a very young age, and it made me easier to make that jump. I was like 9 years old, and I was really into Top 40 and bubblegum music and all the things that were on the radio, and I had I was buying 45s and everything, but I'd never really heard that kind of just low down bluesy rock and roll like that. And I felt a different reaction. And like I write in the book, I wasn't sure what it was about. I didn't know what, but it felt different than when you just kind of are singing along to Tommy James or something. It felt very different. And it started kind of a lifelong thing where I love heavy kind of bluesy rock and roll, basic rock and roll, or not basic, classic. But I also love pop and Motown. And so it kind of gave me it helped broaden my musical sensibilities.
So that's kind of the first sort of music awakening. But I'm wondering if maybe the real epiphany came when you saw that Susie Quattro on TV. You were overseas in the UK. Can you talk about that? Explain what was going on, how that happened?
Yeah, the background context is I quit school because I was miserable in ninth grade, and my mom found a commune school. Like it was like we didn't live there, but it was a commune that had built a school out in the country, and their philosophy was if you leave kids alone, they'll learn what interests them. And it kind of fit with my mom's parenting. And that's when I started playing guitar. So I'm like strumming my guitar. I'm learning, you know, the folk songs and this and that. I was a complete, like, my favorite bands were the Stones and the Who and Led Zeppelin and ZZ Top, you know, and just rock and roll. And yet, so I'm playing guitar. It never occurs to me that I could do that. And luckily for me, my mom's English, and we would go periodically to visit her family. She would quit her job, and she'd cash out her retirement money, and off we'd go to England for a couple of months. And I'm there, and it's 1973, and I'm 14 years old, and Susie Quattro comes on. And I've never, ever seen a woman playing an instrument in a rock and roll band. And I know now that there were other women that had done it, but I'd never seen them. You know, we didn't have YouTube, we didn't have internet. So to me, it was mind-blowing. I'd never seen it. It never occurred to me. And the minute I saw that, I was like, okay. What I wanted to do was find other women, or girls. At that time, I'm a girl. I wanted girls my age that felt the same thing, that wanted to do the same thing. And that kind of drove me for the next decade or more.
So Susie was playing bass, and that's an instrument you'd wind up playing in the Go-Go's. But you mentioned strumming guitar. Guitar was your first instrument, right? No, wait, you had violin lessons first?
I had taken violin in school, but it didn't really click for me. And I had taken some piano lessons too, but guitar was where I felt something, it just felt right. The guitar in my hands felt like the thing I was supposed to do. And yeah, I seeing Susie on bass, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to play bass. I just thought I'm going to be in a band, you know?
Right.
And I got home, went home from that trip and started twisting people's arms, basically, trying to just get, like, my best friend. I said, why don't you play drums? Let's start a band. Because they weren't just floating around, other 15-year-olds. Maybe in L.A., the Runaways were doing it and stuff, but in Austin, Texas, there were no girls. And so I just, that kind of started me on the path.
In the book there, you talk about this guy, Jim, and was he like your first rock guitar teacher in a sense? I mean, he showed you some chords.
Yeah, that happened very, on the heels of coming back, I'm kind of like, okay, how do I do this? How do I do this? I still just got my crappy little, you know, classical nylon string guitars with these visions of, like, you know, rock star. But I don't know how to do it. And so my mom ends up dating for a period of months. he's escaped from prison. He's a drug dealer. He's a biker. And he's a heroin addict. And he also plays guitar and has an amp. And he brought it to our house. And I was thrilled. I was just thrilled. I thought he was the coolest guy in the world. And not only that, he showed me, you know, he let me play his guitar. He showed me how to play. He showed me how to do Chuck Berry rhythm. He showed me Jumpin' Jack Flash. It was another life-defining moment. It really was.
So
it felt very empowering.
So 2 years later, I think this is around 75, you're again in England, and you started playing with some gals. This was Painted Lady. Later, they become Girl School. That's your first all-girl band. Is that right?
Well, I had one in Austin. I had a trio pretty soon after I started playing. I started a band with some of the kids at the hippie school I was at. And then we found a bass player and became a trio. And we tried to do, we wanted to be like ZZ Top. And when that kind of, and then we got a lead, I think I saw the Runaways. I was like, we need a lead singer. Like, we needed a Cherie. We got a singer for a while. It just, it was all this kind of that starting out, floundering. I mean, I guess some people get in bands and that just becomes their band. But it was just kind of flubbing around, learning the ropes of it all. And we went to England again, and I took my guitar because I thought maybe this is where it's going to happen. Maybe this is where I'll find my awesome band and answer the ad in their paper. And I thought, this is it. This is where it's going to happen for me. But instead, I ended up, for the first time, getting fired or kicked out of a band.
But that episode over there, the time, I mean, the punk rock stuff is happening, and that's how you find out about punk rock, right? I mean, they're not actually playing punk rock, but that's going on at the time that you become exposed to it.
Yeah, that's my first exposure, really, and because we'd go hanging out on, you know, King's Road and stuff, and there was punk rockers, and I, you know, I'm just feeling like I'm getting a grip on what, you know, being a rock and roller. And then all of a sudden I see, you know, and start hearing these bands. And what it did was, it was another musical awakening, because in my mind, you had to play, like, I had such a long way to go in my mind. I thought, I got to play like Jimmy Page. I got to play like Eric Clapton. I've got to be like, it's going to be years and years before I'm that good. And then I'm starting to see bands where they're just playing songs, and they're playing them great, and it's music, and it's, I mean, of course, there's some great musicians in punk rock, but for me, it felt like it was attainable sooner. And I thought, well, I'm going to go start the first punk band in Texas, when it didn't work out with girls' school.
And that was the Violators?
Yeah. We thought we were going to be huge.
Well, two things I want to ask you about that. I want to ask you about Carla Olson. But the Violators, you guys tried to open up for the Sex Pistols in San Antonio, and that didn't work out. The band that did open up for them is the Vamps. Now, did you ever see the Vamps?
No, because I was out in the parking lot hoping, hanging around the tour bus, hoping to meet the Sex Pistols. Because in Austin, it was kind of easy to meet bands. They'd come through town, and they would kind of hang out. And so I didn't see the Vamps. So we were really the only punk band in the area. We thought for sure we'd get that gig, and we didn't. And I'm kind of glad. I don't know if we were.
Now, tell us about how you and Carla met, because, you get together to do the Violators, and then you guys wind up going out to L.A. and starting up the Textones. How did all this get together?
Well, I was friends with a guy named Eddie Munoz, who we later introduced to Peter Case, and he was in the Plimsolls. But when I met him, he was in a rock band called Jelly Roll. And I just, him and his bandmate, Jesse, they just really validated my whole deal. And I just kind of looked up to them. Eddie ended up renting a bedroom for me and my mom. And we must have been friends for months when he finally kind of just casually mentioned that his girlfriend, who I'd never met, played guitar, and that he'd actually had a band with her. And I freaked out. I was like, what do you mean? And I went and met her. And like, I couldn't believe there was another. Now, she was a couple years older, but I went and met her, and I mean, this gal, she had a red Marshall stack, and she had like a 54 Les Paul or something, like a really cool Les Paul Jr. and or TV special or whatever. And I was just like, oh my God, I just couldn't believe it, because there's just something about when you find like a partner or somebody that kind of, I don't know, I said two dreamers are better than one. And I felt like we had a like-minded ambition. I don't know. There was something about meeting me, because she was straddling both. She had a full-time job. She was a responsible adult. But something about meeting me, I think, might have ignited her ambition too. So when we moved to L.A., we took the Violators out there, but we kind of broke up, and she and I started the Textones. And we had a pretty good run for close to 2 years. We did some cool things.
Yeah, I want to ask you about your song Vacation in a moment. But well, one of these cool things to me, at least, was Phil Seymour of the Dwight Twilley Band, a man who looked really good in striped shirts, I have to say. And I'm wearing a striped shirt myself right now, but I don't wear stripes as good as Phil Seymour was able to. So he recorded one of your songs after you guys get out to L.A. I think it's a tune, We Don't Get Along. Am I right about that? Yeah. And how did it happen?
Yeah, we met Phil's manager, a guy named Saul Davis, and we were big fans of Phil and Dwight Twilley. You know, I'd seen Dwight at the Armadillo, where I saw where I got all my musical education. And so when you're in LA, it's like there's all these little things seem to happen where it just is a sign. It's a sign that you're in the right place and you're going to make it. And meeting Phil, or actually meeting his manager, and we gave him a demo tape that we'd made, and Tito from the Plugs had produced it. He was a friend, and we gave him our demo tape, and we got a call a few days later, and not only did he want to manage us, but he said, you know, Phil's getting a record deal, and he's going to cut this song. So for me, I felt like, oh, you know, I've made it. It's the weirdest thing with my career. Like, everything made me feel like I'd made it. When you start out just wanting to be in a band,
yeah,
like everything that happens feels like success. It was crazy. I felt like this is it. The path is it's there's no obstructions. It's clear.
Well, during your Textones time, you write of the band is the Textones the first to record your song Vacation. That's also got the lyric in it, All I Ever Wanted, which you use as a title for the memoir. Well, what's the story on that song?
I wrote it when I was 20 years old, and I'd come home to Austin to visit my mom. We were still very close, but leading very different lives, obviously. Yeah. And I'd come back to visit her. I went to Raoul's, which was the punk club where I had helped start. The Violators were the first band to play at Raoul's, and it was this big thriving scene. And I go in, and I meet a guy, and I have not really had boyfriends. You know, I'm kind of just very into my bands and my music, and sure, there's sex and drugs and all that, but it's all kind of just peripheral. What it's really about for me is music. But this guy was just like, I felt like he really liked me. And for about a week, all we did was hang out. And there was something kind of special to me. And on the airplane on the way home, I wrote out the lyrics to Vacation because I really felt like I'd gone home to have a vacation and instead had this little bit of a romance, even though we weren't boyfriend, girlfriend, but there was something about it that had definitely touched me and softened me. And it was such a genuine, coming from such a real place. And I think that there's something about a song that's written in the moment from a real place that resonates. And this song has kind of borne that out because it just seems like it's become I would have never guessed, but it's in a way, I think of it as my signature song. And the Textones version just got placed in, was just in a season of a television show called Hightown. And it's so cool to hear that version being used too. And the producer said they wanted the song, but they wanted something more raw than what the Go-Go's had done. And they found that version. So it's a pretty wild thing to write a song when you're 20. And decades later, it's still
resonate.
Not only relevant, but being listened to in different forms.
Well, when you brought it to the Gals and the Go-Go's, the changes they wanted to make were... How did you deal with that? Was like, oh, okay, whatever, let's do that, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, Charlotte was such my ally, and, you know, they had written such an amazing collection of songs, her and Jane, for the first album, and I had Can't Stop the World on the album. It just kind of slipped in just at the last minute, but they knew I was a writer, and they, you know, welcomed having another writer in the band. But when Charlotte said, I think we could make this chorus kind of go up and go off into another whole place, I was all for it, because I respected her ability. So we sat down together and worked on that, and I remember doing it. I mean, my memory is so intact, but I remember working on the chorus and then showing it to the band and them liking it. And it's funny, though, I was insecure. I mean, I always felt like what I contributed wasn't wasn't enough or didn't match up, because even though I acted real confident and had a lot of bravado inside, I was, you know, I was still a lot more insecure than I let on.
So I agree. I mean, I can see how that would be, but I have to think that the other gals were putting on facades to a degree as well, right? I mean, being on the pressure cooker of having to come up with material and songs, and at some point, and I think the documentary talks about like Charlotte coming up to sort of a writer's block. I mean, now that you're this many years removed from everything, were they sort of having a lot of insecurities at the same time, do you think, or not?
Well, I think it's you know, everyone does in different areas and stuff, but I think I was just talking about that specific, like Can't Stop the World on Beauty and the Beat. I was scared that it wasn't as good as the other Go-Go songs. I mean, I was still the new girl. I'd been in the band, you know, less than 6 months when we did the album, and they had been playing for a couple of years, and all those songs were tried and true. And my song slips in because our producer, Richard Goddard, wanted one more song. And so I felt like, oh, we haven't been playing this for 2 years. It's new. They don't know it that well. So I felt like, oh, I was scared. It took a long time before I understood and accepted that it's a great song for the record. You know, a great song, a great ending song. And a lot of fans have helped me believe that. Mm-hmm. By expressing that to me. But yeah, when it came to Vacation, I think I was just insecure again about having, you know, the first single be a song, the first single after We Got the Beat and Our Lips Are Sealed. Those are huge, perfect songs. You know, they represent the Go-Go's, they define the Go-Go's. And now it's kind of my biggest contribution is going to be the single. And yeah, I was scared. I didn't like being in the place where I could be, you know, not measure up. I was very much about kind of a perfectionist, and, you know, that's just kind of where I was mentally at 22, mm-hmm. 23, and all about bluffing, you know. But yeah, I think everybody to a degree when they're that young, I mean, they were very enamored of me. They thought they bought it hook, line, and sinker, my whole thing. Like, they thought I was this confident, seasoned pro, like, that, you know, had all this experience and, you know, was a really good musician that had played in all these bands. So, you know, they were impressed with me too.
Well, right. Phil Seymour had done your songs.
Yeah. And I'd hung out with for whatever reasons, I had met a lot of people in the business and, you know, but it's all just kind of like, you know, you're getting to know each other, and it's just like any relationship. You kind of want to put your best thing forward.
It's the Tech Stones here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with the original version of Vacation, written by Kathy Valentine, and later a big hit for the Go-Go's. And with that, we end part one of our Coolest Conversations with Kathy. Thanks to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. And next week, join me for part two, when we'll discuss another hit Kathy helped write for the band, Head Over Heels. We'll also talk about this year's documentary about the Go-Go's, the soundtrack that Kathy created for her memoir, and the Go-Go's latest single, Club Zero. That's your next week's Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.